Erica Renee Hoag was last seen walking in the 7800th block of Deer Creek Road in Selma, Oregon, on May 17, 2018. She was 39 years old at the time of her disappearance. There are many factors, both in Erica's life and her disappearance, that make it incredibly difficult for the media to properly cover or for the police to properly investigate her case. The one word that seems synonymous with who Erica is as a person is light. With that in mind, my name is Gwen Berenger, and this is A Light for Erica. A Light for Erica contains topics of a sensitive nature that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is very much advised. Welcome back. I'm glad that you're still listening. I know that my release schedule has been a bit sporadic, but I promise that it's going to improve over time. With that being said, I want to talk about TikTok. Because, oh my god, you guys, the amount of love that Erica's case has been receiving on that particular social media platform is amazing, and I couldn't be more grateful that so many new people have seen her face and heard about some of her case. Honestly, 2020 has been the year from hell, but I am determined to make something good come from it, and I'm glad to have you along for the ride. This episode is going to be a pretty intense one. I thought I'd be discussing the Oregon State Police file about Erica's disappearance, but I'm waiting for a few more things to come through based on information that I gained from that, and I'd rather do a complete episode on it when I have everything in relation to the file together. Don't worry, though. I've got something just as interesting. There's one topic in particular that I have been avoiding, mostly because I wasn't entirely sure how to cover it, and that topic is Erica's schizophrenia and how it may have affected her disappearance. I honestly don't know much about schizophrenia, at least not what it's like to experience it firsthand. It would have been incredibly unfair of me to speculate on these things without having any basis in reality. With that in mind, I asked for a little bit of help from a very dear friend of mine. June has been one of my closest friends for about 16 years now. We've seen one another through everything that life has thrown at us and then some, and I couldn't be more grateful to bestow the title of bestie affectionately on her. I figured that June's perspective could be useful in the podcast, as not only is she literally one of the smartest people that I know, she's also struggled with schizophrenia for most of her life. It dawned on me one day that we'd never actually sat and talked about how her schizophrenia had affected her when we were growing up, nor have we discussed any of the specifics of her disorder. And I figured, if we're going to have this conversation, why not have it now, when it could potentially do some good and bring us some possible insight regarding Erica? I'm going to edit out as little of this interview as I possibly can, so that you can really grasp the complexity of the conversation. Schizophrenia is a very intense, lifelong disorder that can seem impossible to manage to some. And while I'm incredibly glad that June has made it to a place where she is healthy and happy, I would like you to keep in mind that not everybody is so fortunate, and we do touch on that in our conversation. So without further ado, here's my interview with June, my best friend and an actual schizophrenic. I hope it sheds a little more light on what Erica's situation could have possibly been like.
This call is now being recorded.
I love the automated Google thing.
That is hilarious.
Right? Anyway, all right. So I have my bestest friend ever on the line. Her name is June, and we're going to be talking with her about schizophrenia today. So I guess let's just start with a quick overview of just kind of schizophrenia. We know what the media portrays it as, you know, I mean, seeing things that aren't there and hearing things that aren't there. But I mean, is there anything in regards to that that you'd want the audience to know as far as other things that occur?
Well, the DSM-5, the current diagnostic manual for all things mental health, does have a really specific description that goes into certain time frames and stuff. But just kind of a shortened view of it is at least there has to be at least either hallucinations, delusions, or unorganized speech, at least one of those. And then there has to be that, plus it could be all of those, it could be just a couple of those, and it could also include things like negative, they call them negative symptoms, which are things like really flat tone of voice, flat affect, flat, you know, where you just don't express much emotion, is covered under that, or being catatonic, where you're just completely basically out of it and still. And so those are kind of the major things of schizophrenia. And the hallucinations, most commonly they portray them as visual and auditory, which is usually what they are, but they can also affect all senses. So they can be tactile, they can, where you can feel them, they can be olfactory, where you smell them, and they can, and so it's a very broad range. The other
So like,
thing that's important to recognize, I think, is that there are lots of things that cause hallucinations. It's not just schizophrenia. And so you can't automatically jump to that conclusion because it ranges from like sleep deprivation to various medications or drug use, all the way up to brain tumors. So there's a lot of things to kind of rule out when you're diagnosing schizophrenia. As also, another thing that gets commonly mixed up with it is there's depression with psychotic features and bipolar with psychotic features. And those are different in the sense that once you treat the depression or bipolar disorder, the psychotic features go away. In schizophrenia, or you can have schizoaffective disorder, which is schizophrenia plus a mood disorder, which is what I'm diagnosed with. I'm diagnosed with either schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, or schizoaffective depressive type. And that's whichever terminology the doctor prefers to use, those are the same things. And in those, even if the depression is treated, the psychotic features don't go away.
so as far as your diagnosis goes, I guess we'll start with the basics. How long have you been experiencing schizophrenia?
I've experienced symptoms for as long as I can remember. I've had hallucinations from my earliest memories of around 4 years old. I could always hear voices. I thought it was normal because cartoons picture kind of, you know, the angel on one shoulder and the demon on the other and stuff and talking. And I just assumed that everyone had those voices. And it wasn't until high school when I started getting, by that time, the voices were 24/7 and I was starting to have visual hallucinations that I was put on a antidepressant that actually affected the same things in my brain causing the schizophrenia. And so all of a sudden I didn't have the same hallucinations and to that extent. And it was like, oh, people don't hear voice. Like they think things, but there's not a voice that says it. Well, that's strange. And so that was the first time that it's like it all of a sudden occurred to me that that's not normal. I just thought other people were handling it better. And that certainly isn't the normal for most people with schizophrenia. Most people are going to start symptoms between ages 16 and 30. But for me, it started very young.
So you kind of experienced a rare occurrence then in that
Yeah, childhood onset. And, which is
Interesting.
gaining more awareness now. But it's still definitely less common than how it occurs in most people.
That's really interesting. So as far as, like, your undiagnosed period and things like that, like, you just went about assuming that this is normal. Did you ever experience, like, deluded thinking or anything like that? Because I do know that's something that Erica experienced.
I did start having delusions. I started having those around the age of 23. My symptoms progressed through, as I said, I started with just auditory and then it turned to visual. By the time that I was pregnant, I was pregnant and had psychotic symptoms through my pregnancy. And then after my son was born, I started getting, I started having delusional episodes. And those progressively got worse until I needed to be hospitalized.
That must have been a very terrifying experience, not just for you, but for your family.
It was. My husband had already known that I had hallucinations. I wasn't open and honest with doctors at that time about the hallucinations. I was just mainly focused on having the depression and anxiety treated, which obviously those are made significantly worse when you're hallucinating. After my son was born, I realized that I was having a hard time caring for him because I was by myself and I didn't have a way to reality check what I was hearing and stuff. So I learned things through therapy and from friends and about reality checking, where you kind of check to see if things make sense. It's easiest when there's another person with you, because I could, like, ask my husband, hey, do you hear that? And if he doesn't hear that, well, it's probably not there. Or I could cover my ears, and if the sound was the same volume before and after I covered my ears, then scientifically that doesn't make sense for if I'm actually hearing it out, if there's actually hearing from something around me.
So you had enough, like, faculties intact to still try to remain logical.
Yeah, and that's one of the huge hallmarks between hallucinations and delusions. Delusions don't necessarily require hallucinations. It's delusions are the belief in something that is not real, essentially. And sometimes that's accompanied by hallucinations, so you're believing that something is actually there that's not, or you're believing an idea that's not, like your God, or it's kind of the delusions of grandiose.
Right.
Most of my life, I experienced mostly hallucinations, so I still had ways that I could compare them to what other people were experiencing, especially for physical ones. One of the most common hallucinations I had was blood dripping down people's faces or seeing people as if they were dead. And if other people around me aren't reacting to that, well, people are going to have a reaction if blood is pouring down someone's face. Natural response. So if I'm looking around and other people are reacting, I could assume that that has to be a hallucination.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm delusional, then I have this belief in it that it's happening. And so an example of that for me, for one of the worst ones, is thankfully for part of my treatment, we had established that I am not allowed to do anything that is potentially dangerous to prove I'm right about something. Which seems like an odd requirement to have. But it's very helpful when you're driving, which you should not be driving while you're hallucinating or having delusions. But that doesn't mean people, including myself, don't always make the wisest decisions, especially when you're experiencing mental things like hallucinations and delusions. And I thought when I was driving, my vision was flashing between I'd be 1 minute on the road and then all I could see around me was like open fields and I was just driving in the middle of this field. And it kept going back and forth. And since I was delusional, my way of processing was that I must be traveling in between dimensions. And I could drive into oncoming traffic, and I would go through the vehicle, and it would prove I'm traveling between dimensions. I did not do that because we have this rule that I can't do something like that, that could be perceived as dangerous to prove I am right. But in that moment, I was convinced that I could have driven into oncoming traffic and would have been totally fine and gone right through the vehicle.
And the thing that stopped you was just this rule that y'all came up with?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think it's really just kind of fascinating, honestly, how, like, you know, most of your logical faculties can abandon ship, but then some of them kind of stick around to be like, no, this isn't right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very strange thing, and that's part of what makes schizophrenia so unpredictable and people's responses to it so unpredictable, because most of the time they're acting on logic. And if you had the same beliefs as them, you very well could make the exact same decisions that they would.
Right. Now, I know that Erica had some religious background to her family, and that may have contributed to some of her delusions as far as her wanting to, you know, kind of be the savior of mankind. Did you ever experience any of those sorts of delusions with your own, you know, religious background?
For me personally, I did not. Something that I found really helpful for having that I am a Christian, I do believe in the Bible, and for me that was actually incredibly helpful because that was a form of reality checking for myself. For if I wasn't to the point of being delusional, I would have been able to reality check with the passing between dimensions because I don't believe that's a real and possible thing. And so, according to my Christian belief system.
Okay.
And so I found it useful. However, that is a common delusion of people with schizophrenia. Belief that they're God, belief that they're Savior, belief that they have to do some mission or that they have to complete certain steps. It shares some similarities with like OCD, where some people with OCD think they have to do it this way or something bad is going to happen. That can be a common delusion that they feel like they need to do this, and if they don't do this, the world is going to end or the apocalypse is going to start or someone in their family is going to die.
Okay.
And it makes it very hard to fight against those, especially when what the voices are telling you to do doesn't seem that bad. And so it's easy to slip into a mindset of, isn't it better to be safe than sorry?
With Erica's, like, untreated schizophrenia, or rather self-medicated schizophrenia with drugs, do you think it's likely that she just wandered off into the middle of the woods naked, listening to voices or something? Like, out of curiosity?
It's possible, but it would be based on something that she would have a logical thought pattern. So something like if she thought, I don't necessarily believe this is the case, because I do think this is relatively unlikely, but if she thought if she needed to go do something right then or something bad was going to happen, she would do it, whether she was naked or not. There's a good chance of that.
Okay.
Something that's specific to her case that I think about is the whole that the neighbor gun is missing, went missing, mm-hmm. and them finding her bong that was very sentimental to her and that they were saying that she would never leave. Mm-hmm. A possibility would totally be that if she thought she was in danger and needed to protect and that she needed to protect herself and things, is stealing a gun and then hiding the bong and leaving the bong in a woods because she was going to be able to come back to it. And that's a form of protecting that.
Okay.
With schizophrenia, you aren't doing things without logic. It's just that your logic is based on a reality that is not experienced by others. And so while you can, so while people could say, oh, that's crazy, it's not crazy if you are sharing their reality, if you're believing that, oh, I have to do this, or this is bad, or this bad thing is going to happen, or something is going to hurt me. The voices are telling me what something's going to hurt me, but they aren't telling me what. That mm-hmm. can be really common too. Voices do not give all the information mm-hmm. all the time. Sometimes they just give you little tidbits and you have to work out the rest on your own. And, right. or it's like solving a riddle. And so you're doing the best you can based on the information that you're experiencing.
So with this thing's advice and with Hannibal's story about what happened to Erica in mind, I would almost think that maybe she didn't take off trying to protect herself, but maybe she took the gun to protect herself and was trying to get home to her children. Because that was kind of a thing that triggered her, according to the messages that Hannibal sent my anonymous source, the fact that she was unable to speak with her children on Mother's Day, which had been 2 or 3 days before she disappeared.
That is a very real possibility, especially if she was believing that her children were in danger. If the voices all of a sudden were telling her, as a mom, that is such a powerful influence. The moment you feel your children are in danger, you will do almost anything to protect them. And if she was thinking that she needed to immediately, like, run, eat, that would be, even if she was naked, if she all of a sudden believed her children were in danger, and she was needing to do all of these things right then and there, as a mom, you'd go do it.
Now, conversely to that, though, we do have the fact that her delusions were leading her to believe that she was supposed to go save, you know, children in other locations of the world and essentially abandon hers.
Yeah.
Can these two delusions basically coexist within the same brain at different periods of time?
Absolutely, especially at different periods of time. I've had delusions to where I thought my husband was an alien because I could see his figure going in and out, and I could see the alien that was hiding within because it wasn't able to mask its figure as well. And I was totally convinced that he was an alien. And the next day, I was fine. He wasn't, all of a sudden, he wasn't an alien. I realized that was kind of nuts, you know, after the fact. And so especially at different periods of time, hallucinations can, and delusions can completely go back and forth.
All right, so it wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility, you know, the schizophrenia doesn't automatically make her not care about her children forever.
No. And you can, and some people will experience a psychosis that lasts for a very long time and have an existing delusion that lasts for a very long time. Some people will have very short delusional episodes. They can, like I said, the delusions can technically contradict each other, especially at different times when you're having them at different times. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're factoring in her drug use, drugs do affect that. And they can actually, they can worsen hallucinations, but they can also change them and affect them in different ways and affect how you're hallucinating.
And this is why I tell my friends that I know have family histories of schizophrenia that they should not smoke marijuana.
Right. That is very true, because from the information that we have at this time, that can be a factor in symptoms starting. They don't necessarily know that's how they start or anything. And there's often a genetic factor involved. But it's one of those cases that it's better to be safe.
Yeah, nothing with body chemicals is bound to give some weird results if your body chemicals are already kind of messed up.
Yeah, and when you're on medications, you aren't supposed to drink alcohol or anything, and even off medications, it's another thing. I wouldn't recommend drinking alcohol because the same reason. These are things that can affect your brain's functioning and the chemical balances within your brain.
Which makes complete sense.
One thing, I guess, that I feel is necessary to explain, especially concerning her, is that the vast majority, like 99% of people with schizophrenia, are nonviolent. They are known to steal weapons sometimes to protect them because they're convinced they need to protect themselves. But most of them do not have delusions or things relating to violence or to where they feel compelled to do violent acts.
So they'll be more on the defensive than the offensive.
Yes. They are much more likely to be on the defensive than offensive. And so that's an important thing to realize. It's also important to realize that they are much more likely to be, statistically, they are more likely to be victims of crimes because it is a particularly vulnerable population of that you can't trust those around you and you're hearing voices telling you to do things. And you're hearing voices, a lot of times they can tell you to trust people, too, that you shouldn't trust. So it's one of those sad things that on one hand, it's easy to understand some of the stigmas and some of the reasons, like schizophrenics are more likely to run away because of that defensive mechanism. And those symptoms make us more likely to get ourselves in positions of being victims and so it's hard because it's easy to blame them for, you know, that they got themselves in this position. And it's hard to even want to protect a population like that. That's so misunderstood and so erratic because although they see the logic in their actions, others don't. And so a lot of times people are going off of what they think they would do. And that's really hard to get into a schizophrenic's brain of figuring out what they're experiencing at that time. Another thing I think that's important to know is that a lot of people with schizophrenia have really normal and functioning lives. That's a common misconception, too, that, oh, they're going to be, there's no hope for them. And yes, it is harder to get them to seek treatment, and it's a long road. It is something that you can live with. Like I said, for most of my life, I lived with these hallucinations. I functioned what others could perceive as a very normal or even higher than normal level.
Weren't you especially salutatorian or something like that?
Yeah. Yes. I graduated as salutatorian. I had straight A's. I had a higher than 4.0 average. I went to college. I have a degree from college. I was hallucinating through college. I also got on some meds for anxiety during college. The sooner you can catch it, the sooner you can start ruling out things and start getting help. But there's organizations like one that I really appreciate that they're starting now is Students with Schizophrenia. And you can look that up online. And there are accommodations for this is a medical condition. Talk to schools and talk to colleges and get accommodations. Like recording lectures, because it's very hard to remember and take notes during a lecture while you're hearing a voice talking to you. And so things like that can be very helpful. Having someone being able to use someone else's notes for the same reason that you just don't have the concentration level. And so there are resources available, but I'm one of the very lucky ones that my parents had good insurance. I got in therapy at a very young age. Even though they didn't know about the schizophrenia, they knew about the depression and anxiety, and just learning how to cope with those helped a lot. When I was older and stuff, my husband has great insurance. I was lucky. I was able to go inpatient without worrying that I wasn't going to be able to afford some place to live or food. I had a supportive family who could help take care of my child while I was inpatient. By the time you're having delusional episodes, realistically, inpatient is where you need to be to get on the right meds so that you are safe from yourself and are in a safe location to get on medication and to see how those reacts. People view it as, why can't they just stay on their medications? And they don't understand how it feels. A lot of people see just, we still see and think of the treatments for hallucinations as these meds that make you completely zombified. I have been on meds like that. And you can't function like that. You can't function as a parent like that. And thankfully, although they have newer meds, there is a lot of trial and error. I've had allergic reactions to meds where I spent 3 days crying and writhing on the floor because all of my muscles were spasming. And all they could do was wait for the medication to get out of my system and give me some pain relief, which barely touched it. It was so much worse than labor and contractions, to put in a way that other people might be able to understand it. And it took months for my muscles to work okay again because of how much damage was caused just within those 3 days. I've been on medications where you're having tremors and seizure-like episodes, and so they will actually put you on anticonvulsants while they start you on those meds. And even then, I was still having such bad tremors that they still had to take me off of it because it became too dangerous. That's one of those reasons that you should be inpatient, is where they can monitor these things and they can monitor your symptoms. And because these meds do cause issues, I have been on meds that they caused me to lactate. They caused me to start producing breast milk. And it just comes out. And I had to be taken off that because they don't know the long-term consequences of that side effect. The one I'm currently on, that works great. I'm on a great mix of meds. I've been hallucination-free. Some people will never get to a point where they're completely hallucination-free, even medicated. But they can often get to the point of where they can live relatively functioning lives. And through things like reality checking and other things like that, they can live with the limited hallucinations they have and still function at a relatively normal level. But the meds that work for me right now are, for the first year, I was sick on average 20 days per month. So 20 out of 30 days I was sick for the first year because it messes with your white blood cells and causes them to work inefficiently. I am at increased risk of liver and kidney damage and failure. I need to get regular eye exams because it can actually stick in the eyes and end up damaging the eyes. And so even when the medications work, there are so many side effects and long-term consequences. Probably the only time that I was kind of in one of those starstruck stages is I ended up with a psychiatrist who actually was involved in creating most of the newer antipsychotic meds. And was involved in all of the testing and all of the diagnostic criteria and stuff for them. And one of the things he said to me, which it's hard to hear, kind of, is that their focus is really on, no, we don't know the long-term consequences of these. We don't have that data yet. But you could be unmedicated, and then you're not alive to see the end of that data. So the important thing is keeping you alive first. And if you end up with long-term consequences, well, at least you were alive this long.
That's kind of harsh, but I understand kind of where he's coming from in that. You know, it's the science is full of trial and error. And if, you have an immediate need and they think this thing could help, why not
Right.
try
And
it?
with schizophrenia, that's one of those things that it's like you can die because of how you respond to hallucinations. What could have happened if I had not had that rule that I'm not allowed to do something someone else perceives as dangerous to prove I'm right? So there are a lot of dangers involved in staying in that lifestyle and staying untreated. But
This
it's
is
hard to convince someone to get
unfortunately.
treated, especially when your work, so many things are working against you. Medications are expensive. Inpatient is can be hard to get into. You don't have adequate therapy or doctors. You're so far gone that you're completely delusional, and you think people are trying to lie to you and that people are against you. I try to speak out, especially to parents who have children with schizophrenia. I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of them, which is important to me, because there's a tendency to get angry of why won't my child trust me? I've always been there for my child. I've always supported them. I've always loved them. How can they not trust me that I'm trying to do the right thing? And that's very hard to deal with. But when you're experiencing something that is so true to you, when you get to that point where you are delusional, you can't just try to talk someone out of those beliefs, which is another thing that medical people, especially in the ER, need more training on, because their training tends to be try to convince them of what is reality. And that ends up working against them, because if I told you that your spouse left you 3 months ago and they took your kids from you, and you've been experience and you think you're working, but you're not really even going to work, that's all in your head. There's no way that you would believe me. There is nothing I could say to make you believe me. And if I tried to get even five of your friends, you wouldn't believe us. If I got 10 doctors to say the exact same thing, you are automatically going to go, they are conspiring against me. Because the belief is so ingrained in that this is their reality and this is their experience, that when people are trying to tell you, especially when it seems like someone is getting a group of people to tell you the truth, it feels like, oh my gosh, there is some giant conspiracy against you. And which is one of the reasons why treatment early is so important, because sometimes you can get treatment before it progresses to that. Some people may start out with those symptoms, and the easiest approach is honestly talking to them about that must be really anxiety inducing for you. You must be really anxious all the time. Or that must make you really sad, and trying to get on medications that can help with that, which can sometimes lessen that. Or some medications do affect the same chemicals as antipsychotics do. And once you've reached that point to where they're not delusional, you can get a lot farther. But just trying to tell someone that they're wrong on their delusions can be even worse than not saying anything at all.
And is there anything specifically, any sort of wisdom that maybe you'd want to impart to Erica's family specifically, assuming they're listening to this?
First and foremost is you did your best. You did your best, and you're doing your best to cope, to deal with a family member who has schizophrenia is one of the hardest things imaginable, of where they don't trust you, they won't seek help, and you're trying so hard to get them help because you know how bad things could get and how dangerous things can get. And that is so difficult to deal with. And it's not your fault. It's not your fault when a family member has this. Could things maybe have been done differently and better? Maybe, but that's, you didn't have those resources at that time. You didn't have, like I said, I am incredibly lucky to have all of those things work in my favor. It is just as likely that I could have ended up like Erica. And so that's one of the most important things that I can think of to say to them, is that you do the best you can. You're in an incredibly difficult position, and I know that you love her, and I know that she knows, at least during periods of time, that she knew that she was loved.
Very well said. I can't even imagine what she was going through, you know? As far as losing her children, that has to impact somebody as far as feeling like people have turned against them. I definitely know that was a contributing factor to why she stayed away from certain members of her family, because their focus was on keeping the children safe. I mean, and rightly so.
Right, and rightly so. It has to be, because you need to protect the innocent and those who are incapable of protecting themselves. That ultimately, first and foremost, applies to children, because they really have absolutely no control. And it's crucial that they get help, that they get therapy and stuff, because this is important for them to get therapy, not only for the things that have happened to them, for being taken away and being separated from their mom, but also therapy for dealing with that and dealing with those emotions that come from having a loved one who has these type of mental issues, to be able to understand that, no, they didn't abandon me, and that their brain is lying to them. And that's hard to come to terms with, especially for children.
I will say that your child is also really lucky that you have, you know, such a supportive network of family and friends.
Yes.
And were able to get the treatment that you required.
Exactly. And I was able to go for multiple inpatient stays, and I never had to worry that my child wasn't going to be taken care of while I was inpatient. I always had family, that not just my husband was incredibly supportive. It's hard to be supportive of, I can't imagine what I put him through, of having delusional episodes. The first time that I was hospitalized was because I was delusional. I thought I was supposed to kill myself. And it made perfect sense to me, and I thought that he would understand. And I just wanted to, I remembered my grandma thought that she was going to die before my grandpa, and so she got him lots of underwear and clothing because she always did the shopping and she didn't want him to go through that. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to find out what I needed to get for my husband.
Huh.
And he did not understand and made me promise to see my therapist. And before, when I initially went into therapy, when things started going downhill, I've been in therapy most of my life. But at that point, when I was in therapy, I had agreed with the therapist that my goal was that I wanted to be functional without medication. And he said, okay, we can work towards that goal, but if it gets to the point where we see that this is not, where that goal is not going to be a safe, something that can be safely achieved,
mm-hmm.
You need to trust me, and we need to do it in hospital and inpatient. And I agreed, because ultimately the first and foremost on my mind was that my child needs to be safe. And I was never worried about hurting my child, but things like, I couldn't tell if he was crying or if I was hearing crying from somewhere else, or if someone was really knocking at my door or not knocking at my door. And I worried about things like that progressing. And so when I thought I was supposed to kill myself, and my husband brought me to my therapist, and I told him, I thought that he was going to understand and be able to explain it to my husband. He did not understand either. So then it was to the ER, where I thought, for sure, the psychiatric person on staff there for sure is going to understand. He's outside of the emotional aspects. He's not attached to me. And I can remember him talking to me, and they had me in a gown, and they make and my husband sitting in the corner, and my husband is crying, and he's trying to talk to me these logical things about how if you kill yourself, I think the statistic is your child is 33% more likely to kill themselves if a parent has committed suicide. And he's telling me these things, and it, like, it didn't faze me at all because I knew I was supposed to kill myself. And so that led to my first inpatient stay. which I thought once I got inpatient that, well, they'll understand. Like, still, that delusion was so strong that it was just that I couldn't possibly perceive that all of these people who loved me could be wrong on this, like, or that could be right on this. I couldn't perceive that they could possibly be right. My immediate conclusion was, well, the next person will surely understand. And, yeah, the inpatient, they didn't understand either. And so that's really started my journey with getting on antipsychotics and going through all of those different symptoms and experiences with those. But during that time, but I had, you know, think of how many people it took just to get me inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I was inpatient, knowing that I could go back inpatient and having access to the different medications that we wanted to try, and having people that I knew that I never had to worry. I didn't even worry that my child was going to be taken away from me, because I knew that if I'm stable, I can be a good parent. Most people who are schizophrenic, as long as, you know, if they're treated and stuff, they can make great parents. It's similar with other health conditions. The problem is when it's untreated. You can't be trusted to remain in this reality that keeps the people safe around you.
That makes absolute sense. Now, I do have another question, actually, that just occurred to me. I've had a couple of former friends of Erica's reach out claiming that she wasn't actually schizophrenic. Her entire family just turned against her on a whim. Is this kind of a common belief in schizophrenics once they do get diagnosed, the refusal to accept the diagnosis?
Very common. Very common, especially once they're having delusional episodes. Because, like, the examples that I gave before of, for my personal experience and the experience of what trying to tell other people that something else is real,
mm-hmm.
it's very common to believe that they are all against you because as far as you're concerned, your reality is the reality that's real, you know, above all others, this is real. And so as far as you're concerned, if people are trying to tell you that it's not real, they're conspiring against you. And that's one of the reasons why it is so, so hard to even start that process of getting treatment, because of that paranoia and distrust. So that is very common for a person who has been diagnosed to not be willing to believe that they're having issues.
Okay, so this could have very well been something that she was telling people and not just something that people would have assumed.
Absolutely. Schizophrenia doesn't necessarily mean that, I mean, yes, sometimes you can have those negative symptoms and symptoms where it's very clear that you're not all there. But a lot of people go through life actually knowing people who are schizophrenic and not knowing. And you would never know that they were experiencing that. I mean, I went through over 20 years of most of my family not knowing. At one point, my dad was like, you should just carry a cell phone by your ear so people don't look at you strange. He didn't know I was talking to voices. He thought I was just talking to myself. So especially for people who don't know your background and who don't know anything, it can be very easy to be convincing that your family is just nuts. Because as far as your friends are concerned, they're seeing how you are acting in the moment and stuff. And if you seem like a relatively reasonable individual and they aren't seeing you like sometimes how movies portray or how other things portray, as they portray schizophrenia as this very external experience almost, of to where you can clearly tell that the character is experiencing things, when in reality most people never knew that I was seeing things all the time and that I was hearing voices constantly. I went through school with, you know, none of my teachers knew that I was hearing things.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
And we've known each other for how long?
Yeah, that most of my friends did not know. In fact, I can only think of two people in high school that knew that I was having hallucinations. One, because they wanted to date me and I didn't want to date them. And I thought me being crazy might be a good reason for them to just leave me alone. And the other person I had confided in because they knew I was struggling with things and that I could call them at any time. And in high school, one of my hallucinations was a girl who lived in my closet. And so I would see her all the time in my closet, and it was very upsetting to me because she reminded me a lot of kind of the mix between myself, the girl from The Ring, and the girl from The Grudge.
Huh.
Okay? This is not a pretty nice girl living in my closet. Not friendly. And at first it was just that she'd stay down there, and I'd make sure the down part of my closet had a down, like, a section of clothes hanging, but also had a shelf at the top. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't leave space at the bottom, then she would be up at the top and her body would be contorted. And it's kind of like, you know, when you see a contortionist stuck in like a suitcase, you get this really uneasy, awkward feeling. It's made more so awkward when it's a scary, creepy girl living in your closet doing that.
You kind of floating, contorting.
Yeah. And so it really disturbed me when she was up there. And so I tried to make room so that she was at the bottom. But she, as my hallucinations started getting more and more involved, she started leaving the closet and coming closer and closer to me while I was trying to sleep. And so that friend that I could call at any time, I called him one night and told him what was happening. And he was great about it, and he walked me through grounding exercises and was just there to remind me, you know, this isn't real. You know, like, I wasn't delusional, so you can get across that you yourself are acknowledging that this is not real. You know this isn't real. It's hard to fight that response when all of your senses that you're supposed to be able to trust are telling you something different.
Because, you know, you just kind of assume that your senses are correct.
Yeah. Yes, most people can assume. And that's something I've had to acknowledge, is that my brain is not trustworthy. I cannot trust my brain. And I try to remember that even on medication, because I know that someday I could have a relapse. I could have symptoms starting to appear again. When we got on the medication that I'm on, the mix that I'm on, we slowly lowered the dose because these meds can be so dangerous, you want to be on the lowest dose, the lowest dose possible. And so we got down to a dose that I had just started experiencing kind of voices talking, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. And it's like, okay, we need to up it. And so we were able to kind of immediately up it, you know, and it's like, okay, this is the lowest dose you are stable at.
And so I've remained on that dose, but I know that it's possible in the future I may need a higher dose.
Right, because your body becomes kind of adjusted to these certain chemicals being pumped into it.
Yeah. Yeah, your body can be adjusted. I'm used to my, you know, my symptoms got worse as I got older. So I already knew that was a possibility. So I just have to assume that my brain is untrustworthy. And through therapy and stuff, and once I was, like, doctors were starting to treat me for the hallucinations, and once I had opened up to them about it, we established some very firm rules. We established rules of the not doing things safely. We established that I needed to trust my husband and my therapist and my dad were my three people, that I needed to trust their brain above my own. So if I felt like I was supposed to do something and any one of those told me that I shouldn't, I needed to do whatever they said. And that's hard to come to terms with. That's really hard to accept that I can't listen to myself. I can't do what I want if one of these people wants me to do something else. But it's a matter of survival. It's a matter of my health.
Right.
It's a matter of me being able to be a good mom and a good wife.
Which makes absolute sense. And it just, I don't know, it makes me sad that Erica didn't really get a similar experience or treatment.
Yeah, that's something that definitely, it makes me sad too. And it makes me sad about how many other people go through this and aren't the lucky ones, that they didn't have the help and they didn't have access to the things needed. And people who are schizophrenic do end up killing themselves because of dealing with hallucinations, because of these symptoms. It just, even when you're not delusional, it's exhausting. It's exhausting hearing voices in your head all the time. It's exhausting having them tell you things. Even when they're not, people often view them as, oh, they're only mean voices. And they aren't all the time. My voices could even be helpful at times. And just that they're commentating about my day. And I'd go to the store and be telling myself I need milk and eggs. And they'd go, bread, don't forget bread. And I'd go, okay, bread. Yep, that's right. I need bread too. And so there is a lot of times of just conversing with them. And
once
it's hard.
Once you've gotten used to that sort of thing, I would imagine that, you know, not having your friends in your head anymore would be kind of hard.
It was. And some people do end up quit taking medication because they don't know how to cope with that. And for me, I spent a lot of time praying when my hallucinations were gone because I didn't know how to deal with that, of not having someone constantly in your head that you're talking to. What are you supposed to do with yourself? This is not normal. But it wasn't normal for me. And so, yeah, and so that's what I did, is I did a lot of praying to God, and I encourage others to that, even if they aren't Christians, I encourage them, if that's something they're really struggling with, when the voice, if they've just started on meds and that these voices are gone and they're having trouble coping with that, I encourage them, is to just talk to the universe. You don't even have to really believe that it exists. It can help just to talk to something like that. And then over time you do get used to it, but it took a solid 2 years before I was used to not having a voice constantly there.
I would imagine you've been dealing with it for such a long time at that point that, yeah, it would be kind of shocking to suddenly have some, you know, quiet in your brain and being the only one there.
Yeah, I did. And similarly, it'd be really hard for someone to deal with all of a sudden that there has, if they don't experience this, and all of a sudden you have a radio talk show voice on your phone, in your ear all the time, talking to you. That'd be really hard to learn to deal with and cope with. And it's a very different thing to be able to get used to of when you do have some, when it feels like you have someone there all the time with you. And it can be scary. It can be lonely. There are definitely nice moments of it, because living with voices 24/7 is very, very difficult to deal with, even if they're nice voices. but they usually aren't nice all the time. but they definitely aren't. I feel like media sometimes portrays it as they're mean all the time, and they aren't.
They probably can be for some people.
Yeah, they probably can be, but I'd say even I've been involved in different support groups for a long time for schizophrenia, and like I said, I've had the ability to talk to especially adults and parents of children and stuff, and a lot of times they, even the ones that have negative mostly, the voices still a lot of times are just commentating on their day. But that can get totally upsetting too. In high school, I would go cry in the bathroom and beg the voices to just stop for a little bit. And after begging for a while, sometimes they'd go, okay, we'll give you 1 minute and 38 seconds. It's always so random, the time they chose. Why they couldn't choose like a solid number, I don't know. But, and see, even now I still refer to them as they, even though it's my brain doing this, but and all of a sudden I would get quiet for that exact amount of time. And then it was back to, but I could deal with it better when I had small breaks, at least.
Yeah, it serves as kind of a buffer so that you can prepare your brain for when they return.
Yeah, just to not hear things for just like a few, even just a few seconds, but like a few minutes and stuff of not having constant talking. No one wants to listen to someone talk to them. If you're a parent of a young child, you know this, that no one wants to listen to someone talk to them 24 hours a day, no matter how nice or cute they are.
Oh, and that is especially true for your child.
Oh, yes. I love him dearly. My son is amazing and wonderful, but we are at the stage where he talks a lot.
Yep. I mean, at least you have a little bit of practice hearing people talk 24/7, so there's that.
This is true. And that is actually probably something that contributes to me being a better parent. Strangely enough. I learned a lot of skills of these coping skills and coping with different life things. Coping with loss, having gone through the loss of those voices. That's coping with a sense of loss. There are a lot of things you can learn from and benefit. It's kind of the same, you know, with trauma survivors and victims of different things of, you know, I totally hate when people say, well, it made you a better person. No, how you coped with it made you a better person. How you coped with the trauma made you a better person.
Even so, you should not have had to cope with that trauma.
Right. But good can come out of things like this. I can be more patient with people. I do have this ability now of being able to talk with people about schizophrenia and to be able to talk with loved ones and have other people. And because I'm open with it, people, a lot of people do reach out to me. Now, do I have to put up boundaries? Absolutely. Obviously, I need to make sure that I'm sane and my stability needs to come first before I can help others. But it does give me an ability to understand and to empathize with people like Erica, which you're able to empathize with and stuff, but a lot of people have a hard time doing that because they see this person as someone who's different.
Absolutely. The amount of times people have kind of been like, why are you looking for this schizophrenic hippie to me is absurd. I'm like, well, why not? Why aren't you?
Right. They can't understand that. And I think it's important for people like me who, especially who have things well managed and treated, to be able to talk to other people and explain, because that's why I'm a huge advocate for children with schizophrenia, is knowing that they can't. It's hard enough for adults to explain the symptoms they're experiencing. imagine being a child and not having any of this, you know, knowledge of the world or psychology or how people think to be able to describe what you're experiencing.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
So as far as your advocacy goes, are you, like, planning on doing something with that in the future more so? Like, getting involved with organizations on a more consistent level?
I'm really undecided. Like I said, there are groups out there. I am a huge fan of Students with Schizophrenia, and I do hope that eventually maybe I will get more involved with that. Part of me would like to be more involved. Part of me knows it's a very emotionally taxing community to be a part of sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is such a hard thing to deal with and a hard thing to cope with, and how many people do not want, are resistant to getting treatment. It can make you feel very helpless. But also, so on one hand, I'm very passionate about it, and I was much more of an advocate, I think, right after I was getting treatment and stuff, and when my son was in a place that didn't require as much care and attention. And as you know, my son is special needs, and so a lot of my focus ultimately has to be towards my family and him and my husband. And so right now that ends up taking up a lot of my time. But I do try to be open with my experiences, and especially open to friends if they have need someone to contact or have a family member who wants to talk to me. I usually try to be there for them, especially.
And that's amazing, honestly, because like you mentioned, how emotionally taxing something like that can be.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and especially when you don't have, you know, on one hand, the internet is great. I am so thankful for it. I'm so thankful for the support groups that I'm a part of. Really, it just helps you reach so many more people. But one of the downsides to it is you don't have the same connection. So, like, if you were really struggling, I know who to, being your best friend, I know who to contact. I know resources in the immediate vicinity to be able to get you help. When you're online with someone, oftentimes you don't know their real name. You don't know where they live. You have no way of getting help for this person who is experiencing something incredibly traumatic. And especially when they're in a position where they're in danger, you have no way of forcing them to get help and no way of reaching those who know them personally to get them help. And that is very, very difficult when you get into advocacy.
So Erica's lifestyle of, like, hopping around to different states and working on different farms and going to rainbow gatherings and so on could have potentially, you know, impeded her treatment.
Yes.
Just because, you know, her family didn't have exactly a solid lock on where she was at, and they would have been unable to even find resources for her with how, you know, she just would wander off.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, that it can be very hard for family members to even get someone help, especially when they live that type of lifestyle, of nomadic lifestyle, of moving around and from place to place. And she was at a point where she was still able to get, most of the time, she was able to get her immediate needs met, like food and shelter. And so that also makes it that since those needs are met, even the people around her aren't going to force her into seeking mental health treatment. Even if they were able to realize that she had some serious mental health issues, it's very hard to force treatment on someone nowadays. On one hand, that's a really good thing. It means that people aren't just stuck in institutions for the rest of their lives. That used to be the only way to handle family members with schizophrenia, was putting them in institutions or keeping them kind of locked up as a family secret. I do have a genetic history. So I do have past relatives, and it's hard finding information on them because it was so secretive, because you just didn't talk about it with other people, or they were locked up in an institution and you didn't want to talk about it. Nowadays, the only way that you can get someone in non-voluntarily is on a suicide hold or where they're a danger to others. And they have to, like, you have to basically have pretty good evidence that they are a danger to themselves or others. Right. Like, for me, it was pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which I still, even then, I did go in, I did sign the papers voluntarily. They gave me that option, and I did sign it voluntarily. But yes, at that time, they could have totally put me in voluntarily. But even with that, they're normally only allowed to keep you 72 hours. And unless after that period, you have to get, if you're trying to keep someone involuntarily, a judge has to be involved and decide that you are still a danger to yourself or others. And so if someone's just experiencing delusions that they think they're supposed to be the savior of the world and they're not out to hurt themselves and they're not out to, like, and that she's not out directly, that it didn't seem like she was going to, you know, try to kidnap her children or something, that she just wanted to see them even, but not kidnap them. Mm-hmm. Unless she was very clearly said things that made that one of those two things was going to happen, that she was going to kill herself or she was going to kidnap her or hurt someone. I bring up the example of kidnapping because, honestly, with what we know of her, or what others have said about her and stuff, it doesn't seem like she ever had any interest in hurting her kids at all. So I kind of dismissed that one as an option. But unless she said that, like, in hospital, even if you did manage to force her in, and even if you managed to get enough people to lie and say that she wanted to kill herself, and say that she said that to you, unless she said something while she was in there for the 3 days, that, you know, they're just going to keep her those 3 days and then she's back out again. Now, they can sometimes find medications. Medications take a while to work, and it's really hard to get past those initial side effects. Sometimes you can get someone, you know, to the point of where inpatient, where they realize they need more help. But a lot of times 3 days is not long enough for that. And
right.
Sometimes, but it can also, sometimes when you get out and stuff, it can lead to them contacting family or friends immediately of trying to get help from, you know, they let you out the doors, but that doesn't mean you have anywhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can lead into them contacting family members and stuff. But
all right.
But when family knows where you live, they can't, even if they know where you live and know where you're at, they can't force you to follow through with treatment. It's important to recognize that schizophrenia does affect people very differently. I feel like that was adequately stated with all of my examples, but...
Schizophrenia is a very, you know, it's like depression. It doesn't affect everybody the same way.
Yes, it affects everyone very differently, and it also, not only does it affect people differently, it does mean that you can't just automatically go to one medication. They don't know exactly what it's affecting in the brain. And so they have their kind of guesses, but some meds do make people worse. Some meds, it's not just even about the side effects. Some meds don't end up working for people and don't take away the hallucinations.
And I just want to say, I feel like it's sort of amazing that modern, like, medicine has not quite caught up to what in the brain is necessarily causing schizophrenia. You know, we can make nuclear weapons and bombs and shit all day long, but let's not treat mental illness.
That's true. And so much research has gone in. I remember I was in behavioral neuroscience when they first started doing implants in the brain to stimulate muscles for patients with strokes. And those, the resources that go to that they've, to the point of putting electrodes in the brain, but we still can't tell what causes certain mental health issues.
Brains are weird, dude.
Brains are very weird.
I'm just glad that you were fortunate enough to have a supportive network to get help for yours. And like I mentioned earlier, it's sad that Erica didn't really have the kind of network that you did. She had a network. She has family who cares about her deeply. But they're just at such a loss right now with how to handle her going missing, and they were at a loss before with how to handle her mental illness.
And like I said, it's incredibly hard to treat people once they've gotten to that point.
And honestly, the only way we could even really know how her symptoms presented to her is by asking her, and we can't exactly do that.
That's true, because, like you said, like, you didn't know I even had hallucinations for all of high school and stuff, and I had been having them my entire life.
Yeah, and I didn't know until recently. Although I feel like we can both agree that things started worsening because pregnancy hormones happened.
It's definitely hard to tell. Things got worse after that, but that's also the prime age when people start experiencing symptoms and also where things start to get worse. So I've thought about that, and it's really hard to know. It's like, did that step things up and ramp things up incredibly? Because I didn't have delusions until after he was born. But it could have been progressing there naturally, because even before he was born, my symptoms were progressing.
And judging by the current ages of Erica's children that I know of, it seems kind of likely that maybe she experienced pregnancy in her, 20s/maybe her early 30s, which would also be the prime time for these things to start becoming prevalent.
Yes, prime time for things becoming problem, and it's much more, you can have psychosis during pregnancy without schizophrenia, without any other symptoms. Some people do have that specifically for that time frame. And then once they've delivered and had the baby and their hormones return to normal, it goes away. So it's something that can be even just the fact that it can happen on its own without schizophrenia, the chances of it happening are so much greater when you add in schizophrenia. So it makes sense that symptoms could definitely worsen during that time.
Exactly. Just even from our non-doctor viewpoint.
Yeah. Yes, I have done a lot of research. However, I am not a professional in this.
You're a professional schizophrenic. You're not a professional doctor.
Yes. Now, which means I do have much more information on schizophrenia than a lot of doctors out there, but, well, and my experience with talking to others and my experience with just research in psychology. However, my life is not dedicated. There are doctors who dedicate themselves to mental health issues, who dedicate themselves to psychotic disorders.
Yeah.
They are going to know a lot more about the experiences of others.
You are not wrong there. But I do feel like this conversation is going to be really helpful for my listeners.
Yay!
So thank you so much for sharing your story. I am absurdly proud of you for not only doing this, but for, just coming out the other side.
I hope the thing turns out good, and I am proud of you too, because it takes a lot to keep going with something like this. I understand the emotional taxation
these types
of things to have, and pursuing cases like this is something that's very emotionally taxing.
Absolutely. All right, so I'm going to, I think, end the recording here.
Okay, thank you for having me on and for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being so willing to talk.
Now, I don't know about you, but to me, that interview was possibly one of the most eye-opening conversations that I have ever had about mental illness. I don't think that I ever truly comprehended the fact that the schizophrenic brain does still work with some semblance of logic to it. It's just not a logic that is present within our reality as mostly neurotypical individuals or individuals who do not struggle with schizophrenia. Although my interview with June may have been particularly lengthy, it was very, very informative, and I am so grateful to have had her input on this episode. Everybody is different. The experiences that people go through, whether they have mental illnesses or not, the way that everybody's brain functions, has some variations to it. And honestly, I am so glad that we were able to get a little bit more clarity regarding the mental illness that Erica suffered with, and we're kind of able to hopefully understand things from her perspective a little bit more, as far as what could have motivated her to take off in the middle of the night from that place in Selma. I genuinely hope that Erica Hoag is out there somewhere, and that she's just experiencing something that is currently beyond our realm of reason. But I will also add that the fact that she hasn't shown up in any hospitals or anything, that she hasn't contacted her family in over 2 years, that worries me. And that leads me to believe that even if she did perhaps take off from Selma voluntarily, there may be a fairly high chance that she is no longer with us. And I hope, I really hope that that is not the case. The one thing that I do know for certain, though, is that I'm going to keep looking until such time as there is a resolution and Erica Hoag is found. So, listeners, what do you think? Do you think that Erica is possibly still out there and just not in her right mind? Or do you think that it's more likely that she is no longer with us? In any case, especially if you live in the Southern Oregon or General Oregon area, please keep an eye out. Please look up Erica Hoag online. Look at her face and just pray that you see that face somewhere. Please ask whatever it is that you happen to believe in to return Erica home to her family and friends and those who love her. One more quick note, I'm sure you've noticed that the audio quality has kind of shifted throughout this episode, and I must apologize for that. I am experiencing some technical difficulties right now involving my microphone and my computer, and the two of them don't seem to want to connect anymore. So I'm stuck using a headphone microphone until I can get this issue fixed. And with that, thank you very much for listening to this episode of A Light for Erica. I'm going to play the outro now, and hopefully see you the next time around.
Erica Hoag is 5'6" tall and weighs between 100 and 130 pounds. She has sandy blonde hair that is styled into dreadlocks and maybe dyed rainbow colors and hazel eyes. She has a tattoo of a marijuana leaf on her right bicep. She was last seen in the 7800th block of Deer Creek Road in Selma, Oregon. If you know Erica or have information regarding her disappearance, please contact the Oregon State Police. If you do not feel comfortable doing that, you can email me at alightforerica@gmail.com or call or text 541-450-9734. A very special thank you to Matthew Sell, who created the music for this podcast, and a big thank you to the friends online and in person who I'm able to bounce ideas and thoughts off of. Most of all, thank you for listening to A Light for Erica. I'm Gwen Berenger, and together, I hope that we can bring Erica Hoag home to those who love her.